You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. And today on the show, you're going to hear an interview with Joan Wickersham, author of the new short story collection, The News from Spain, published by Knopf. Joan Wickersham was born in New York City and grew up there and in Connecticut. Her memoir, The Suicide Index, Putting My Father's Death in Order, published by Harcourt, was a National Book Award finalist. She is also the author of a novel, The Paper Anniversary. Her fiction has appeared in magazines, including Agni, Glimmer Train, The Hudson Review, New England Review, Plowshares, and Story, and has also been published in The Best American Short Stories, The Best American Non-Required Reading, and other anthologies. She has published essays and reviews in Glamour, Yankee, The Los Angeles Times, and the International Herald Tribune, and her op-ed column appears regularly in the Boston Globe. She has read her work on National Public Radio's On Point and Morning Edition. She also writes frequently about architecture, including The Lurker, a column she created for Architecture Boston magazine. She has received the Plowshares Cohen Award for Best Short Story and has been awarded grants by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, the McDowell Colony, and Yaddo. She graduated from Yale with a degree in art history, and she lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with her family. I spoke to Joan Wickersham by phone earlier this month, and I began by asking her to read from one of the stories in her new collection, The News from Spain. One of the interesting things about this collection is that every story in the book is titled The News from Spain.
Incredibly, Harriet didn't die. Her cancer never came back. She kept having more surgeries, to insert a catheter for the chemo drugs under her chest wall, to remove it again because of recurrent infections, to remove scar tissue in her abdomen, to remove more scar tissue. Rebecca kept driving down and spending time with her mother. The glow wore off. What a disconcerting thing to feel, to acknowledge. It wasn't that she was sorry Harriet was still alive. It was more that she couldn't keep it up. The attention, the rapport, the camaraderie, the aimless joy of just hanging around with her mother, watching the news. She had burned herself out, just as Peter and her friends had warned that she might. But looking back at the time when Harriet had seemed to be dying, she couldn't imagine having managed it any other way. Harriet started feeling that Rebecca wasn't visiting often enough. It was true she was coming down less often, but oh, that enough, that tricky, guilt-laden word that doesn't even need to be spoken between a mother and daughter, because both of them can see it lying there between them, injured and whimpering, a big, throbbing, violent-colored bruise of a word. What about Easter? Harriet asked, plaintively, coldly, in a resolutely plucky way that emphasized how admirably she was refraining from trying to make Rebecca feel guilty. It could have been any of those ways of asking, or any of a number of others, all of which did make Rebecca feel guilty, and angry, and confused about whether to say yes or no. Part of the burnout took the form of an almost frantic protectiveness of her own time whenever Harriet wasn't sick. If her mother needed her, she dropped everything and went. If her mother didn't need her, she wanted to feel free to say no. Harriet, on the other hand, seemed to feel that the time Rebecca spent caring for her didn't count. Hurting, drugged, frightened, throwing up, that's not what Harriet called spending time with her daughter. The watching the news part was engrossing and sometimes fun, but it was more like a jailhouse party, a desperate entertainment concocted by people who have very little to work with. Harriet wanted to travel with Rebecca, to go on a cruise to Alaska or the Panama Canal, or to see Moscow and St. Petersburg, for heaven's sake, all those mythical places that you could now suddenly actually go to. Rebecca had no desire to travel with Harriet, and she was getting ready to start her bookstore, looking for space, making a business plan, applying for loans. A bookstore, Harriet said. With your education, you want to start a store, and one that doesn't even have a hope of making money? It's what I care about, Rebecca said. I worry about you, Harriet said. What is your life adding up to? Rebecca was hurt, furious. What did a life, anyone's life, add up to? Why did Harriet feel she had a right to say things like that? In her head, Rebecca wrote the script for what a mother should say in this situation. That's wonderful. They had one of their old fights, made worse by the fact that Rebecca hadn't realized these old fights were still possible. The recent long entente around Harriet's illness had lulled Rebecca into a false sense of safety. She felt ambushed. Then Harriet sent Rebecca a check for quite a lot of money. To help with the bookstore, she wrote on the card. You can't afford this, Rebecca said. It's what I want to do, Harriet said.
Thank you very much for reading that. So that was Joan Wickersham reading from The News from Spain, Seven Variations on a Love Story, which is published by Knopf. I love that story. I think it's wonderful. And part of what's great about that story is that there's this kind of quiet part of the story that has to do with the fact that Rebecca has a sister who's not involved, which I thought was it's funny because you didn't make a very big deal out of that, but it is this quiet pressure that pushes her to this point of having to help and feel a little bit guilty about the fact that she doesn't want to more, even though she's not part of what you just read.
Yeah.
Writing Kath's character,
yes,
and figuring out how you wanted her to fit into this whole scheme of things.
Yeah. Well, you know, where I think that came from intuitively is I have a lot of friends, and I myself have been in the situation with the mother who was sick over years and years and years, and I've seen friends of mine go through that. And I find that generally, no matter how many siblings there are in a family, there tends to be one person who ends up being the front and center caretaker once that situation arises. And what I see is that there can spring up then between the parent and child a very, very complex relationship, which in a sense is a love story.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I was trying to do in The News from Spain was to write love stories that go beyond the bounds of what we usually think of as love stories. The conventional idea of a love story is two people meet and fall in love,
right,
and then something happens. And I think, in fact, our love stories that we experience throughout our lives come in all different shapes, sizes, colors, forms, and a lot of it is stuff we don't have words for. So for me, for this story, that presence of the sister who's not there, I'm really writing about the sister who's holding the bag.
Yeah.
And what happens between that sibling and the mother, in a way, because they're thrown upon each other, they're so dependent upon each other, and that creates a kind of resentment, but also a very, very deep love and a kind of camaraderie of just two people who are almost in the same disaster together, and what are they going to make of that relationship?
Yeah, and it is so interesting because it is a disaster. I mean, neither of them wants this to be the situation, and both of them feel probably a little bit guilty, although Harriet, I'm not sure her guilt would come through quite so much, but
mm-hmm.
a little bit. I liked the relationships between all the people in this story, and even though Kath is kind of this quiet presence that's off stage, there is this almost triangular feeling to their relationship as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you experienced it that way, because one of the things I was also trying to do with these stories, I like the idea that a story can work the way a novel does in terms of the richness of the world and the feeling that there are people off stage. You know,
mm-hmm.
sometimes I think a short story can be so austere that its experience distilled down to these few crystalline drops. And that's a beautiful kind of short story, but that's not what I was trying to do here. I was trying to write little novels. And so the idea that this character that doesn't even appear in the story but felt to you like a character, I love that you said that, because that to me is more like the experience you have when you read a novel.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Another thing that you do that's sort of more novelistic is you often in these, well, not often, but at least twice that I can think of off the top of my head, you give multiple characters a narrative point of view within a single story, multiple being usually two, but you know, a lot of stories won't necessarily branch out that way because, I don't know, maybe it's getting into too much, but I thought it worked beautifully. And you very often have a character in one scene going through his or her own moments, and we're in their head, and then the next scene we're in somebody else's head. So I liked that.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't do that consciously, but my husband actually pointed that out after he read the book. He said a lot of the stories, it's two different couples, and the interaction in the story is actually between a member of one couple with a member of the other couple, whether it's mm-hmm. a friendship or whether it's a relationship of a, you know, in one of the stories, it's a paralyzed ballerina who's married to a choreographer who's away and being unfaithful, and it's really her relationship with her caregiver is the significant relationship in the story. So a lot of times it's, you know, two different couples, and then it's some kind of intersection between people that are actually romantically involved with someone else.
Yeah. I love that each story has the same name. Every story in this collection is called The News from Spain. And the context for that title is so different in each story, and I just love that. So I wondered a little bit about what was the first story of the collection, and how did you decide to keep going with this sort of as a theme?
Well, you know, I actually started with the theme.
Did?
Yeah, it's funny. This was almost an exercise I set myself to see if I could write stories that all would share this same title. And I think a lot of times writers are asked, where does the idea come from? Mm-hmm. And I don't always think that matters, where the idea comes from. I think it's more, what did you do with the idea once you had it? And did it work? Did it become meaningful? And so I started with the idea of writing stories all with the same title, The News from Spain. But I only would have stuck with that if it had come to have a resonance and a meaning and a purpose beyond just that exercise. And so the first story I wrote was actually the very first story that's in the collection, the one about the couple. The wife has just discovered that her husband has been unfaithful, and they're going to a wedding, or not a wedding, excuse me, an engagement party of another couple who are somewhat ambivalent about getting married. And that story just kind of came to me almost whole. It was one of those stories that it took, you know, took about a week to write, but it was all there in my head as I was writing it. And then the next one was the one about the race car driver who was killed at a young age, and now his widow is in her 70s, and she's a paid companion living with a rich couple, and the story is basically a biographer comes to interview her and what happens during that day of the interview. That was the second one. And so I think that as I wrote these stories, the phrase, The News from Spain, started to accumulate meaning and mood, and it became really about, in each story, I think it's something that's elusive and maybe hard to put words to, but it started to really came to embody the yearning. I think each of these stories is a story about yearning mm-hmm. for something you can't have, and you want it, and you don't even know what it is. And somehow that phrase, The News from Spain, came to really embody whatever that thing is that we all want and it's always out of reach.
Now, you obviously came up with at least seven ways of looking at The News from Spain. And I'm wondering, since you stopped writing the book, are they still jumping out at you?
Well, they sort of are. I mean, it's funny. It became one of those things where almost anything that happens, I could start to look at it through that frame. So it was, it's one of these things that I don't think I would write The News from Spain Part 2, but I could imagine, you know, at some point in the future using that as a prompt to write a short story, and then just when the story's finished, I could give it a different title.
Yeah.
That's the other thing with, I think, writers and ideas. I think sometimes you have an idea that helps get you jump-started, and then it doesn't become a useful idea, but it at least helps you generate material. This one actually turned into something that meant something. But sometimes I've come up with writing exercises or prompts for myself, and they don't have particular resonance for anybody else, and so I just then bury my tracks when I'm finished.
The line, The News from Spain, you had, you know, that line showed up in each story, in addition to being the title of each story, and the line about the news from Spain about the seashells, I had never heard that before, and I just loved that. These two people are sitting on a beach, and he picks up a seashell and says, you know, that I think his grandfather used to tell him that if you put the shell to your ear, you could hear the news from Spain. And did you make that up, or is that something you've actually heard before? I loved
no,
that.
No, I made that up. I mean, but I think what I was trying to get at is that kind of thing in childhood that your parents tell you that you can't. That character is a character who is really missing. His parents have died fairly recently, and he's really missing them. And I think part of the loneliness that character has is the there are these things within a family that are part of the language and culture of that family. And once your parents are dead, and particularly if you're not close to your siblings, it's sort of like nobody else in the world really knows what that means. I mean, I can think of, you know, things that my father used to say when I was a little kid and I was tired and we'd be going up the stairs, like certain things he'd say as he was putting me to bed. And they were just wonderful. They were nonsense to anyone else, but to me, they really, really mean something. So that particular phrase was made up, you know, the news from Spain was made up there. You know, my father never said that to me, but my father said other things like that to me that nobody else would ever understand, and that's what I was trying to capture there.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and it's funny because it wouldn't necessarily mean anything to the woman he's sitting with on the beach, who's his close friend, that it was from his grandfather. Grandfather, right? It was his grandfather.
His father.
His father.
But I think it's the same. It's that same idea. You know, it's just that thing that is said to you as a child that just means something to you, and you nobody else will ever get it.
And how important it was to him came through in the story. The fact I actually wanted to talk about that story. I loved the situation in that first story. I keep being tempted to name the story, but they're all called The News from Spain. You've already sort of mentioned what the plot was of the story. One couple has such a great natural marriage, except that it's in trouble. And then another couple is entering into a marriage that doesn't look at all natural or meant to be necessarily, but it's mutually desired for various reasons. And it's all set against this backdrop of the childhood home of the wife in the first marriage. But anyway, it's just there's a lot of complication in the lives of these characters, and it's just so beautifully set up. And there's just a lot to think about in this story. And the two marriages sort of held up next to one another is so much, it's just so wonderful to think about. And it's funny, at one point as I was reading it, I had this thought, oh my God, I hope she's not going to have, you know, this woman sleep with this man. I hope that doesn't, and you know, it didn't. So yeah. I was so happy. But, you know, it was like, I loved the fact that this story didn't go down any well-worn path. It was just a situation between very real people, and I loved it. Anyway,
it's interesting that you say that too, because one of the you know, again, it's always dangerous. The minute you start to generalize about stories or novels, you can immediately think of 2,000 exceptions. But I do think that sometimes in fiction, people feel that it's necessary to have things acted out. You know, in order to create a kind of drama, things have to be acted out so that we can see the ramifications. But my feeling is that most of us are pretty mature adults with pretty good judgment, and so we're not going to act out all this melodrama. It goes on internally. So I was trying to write about feelings that we have that we don't act on. You know, I don't need to act on them as a person, and as a writer, I don't feel that I need my characters to act on them just so we can see what would happen. I think that people have minds and judgment and imagination, and I was trying to write about characters that have minds and judgment and imagination, so they can have these strong feelings that don't get acted on, and then it's partly, you know, it's the drama is partly internal, but the drama is also partly what happens when we don't act on these things. You know, what does it feel like to not act on these things?
Right. It's a series of choices, and they can choose either way. They don't have to choose the thing you necessarily expect.
Yeah.
Although you do have to believe that they made the choice.
Yeah, and you do have to believe. Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's what makes it interesting. I think that's really what fiction is about in general, I think, is what are the choices that people make.
Right. Right. I once heard a writer say that she likes to keep three balls in the air in any story that she writes, three threads or ideas or concepts to work with. And in reading your stories, I felt like maybe you have a similar work ethic, that you have a certain amount that you like to keep going on. And I wondered if I just am picking up on that, or do you have a general blueprint along these lines when you write a story that you have a certain number of things you want to see happening?
Not at all. And in fact, I'm always amazed when writers can make a statement like that, because, and what I've realized is that it must be true for them, you know, that's not the way I work. I mean, for me, it's much more intuitive. In fact, this first story that you and I have been talking about the two couples, the two, mm-hmm. you know, the two different marriages, at one point when I was writing that story, I actually had a third couple in there as part of the story, and it just felt so complicated and heavy and weighted down, and I just in the course of that week that I was writing the story, I just remember waking up one morning and thinking, what if I just get rid of that third couple? What happens? And suddenly I could feel the story just, it was almost as if we unloaded excess baggage and suddenly the plane could take off. it really was. So for me, it's more intuitive, and it's more going down the wrong path and then realizing, ugh, this story feels kind of waterlogged. Let's see what we can do about it. It's much more intuitive.
Okay. All right. There's a character who's mentioned in this same story, called Vikram. And he was such a perfect heel, and I won't go into great detail, but he was I knew exactly who he was from reading your short paragraph description of him. And I wondered if Vikram was based on a real person, and then I also wanted to ask you about writing fiction that might be based on real people. So.
Yeah. I don't think he was specifically, but as you say, we all recognize that guy. So in a way, I suppose he must have been, but I'm not aware. I wasn't connecting the dot. I wasn't taking a real person and changing his name to make him that guy. So that's the answer to that question. I think that the bigger question that you're asking, you know, it's funny. I have great envy sometimes of writers who seem to make people up out of mm-hmm. whole cloth, you know, For me, I do tend to use suggestions from real life, but I hope that they're only suggestions. I don't want to presume to get inside the heads of people that aren't me. So I have to really believe in my people as fictional characters. And particularly with the news from Spain, there are several stories later on in the book that are really take the suggestion is of actual historical personages
or characters.
And I wanted to be really our characters. I wanted to be really careful that I wasn't presuming to write, you know, historical fiction about this actual person. But clearly that person's life was the suggestion and the jumping off point for the story. But I was really interested in part of the whole idea of this book is that when you're writing fiction or when you're reading fiction, you're always inhabiting a fictional world. You're not trying to kind of animate.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's not like trying to write about a specific historical figure and like what were they actually thinking in that moment. It's more just, you know that story. We all know that story. Let's try to turn that into an emotional universe that we can inhabit, but without presuming to say we are writing about that character and what he or she felt.
Thanks. One of the stories in the collection involves a teenage girl who is one of only two girls attending an otherwise all-boys school, which was this great setup. And I found it interesting that you chose to write this narrator's point of view in the second person, because she's a self-conscious girl. She considers herself too tall and sort of ungainly, unattractive, and she describes herself as conspicuous but invisible. But, you know, the fact that that is written in the second person, maybe because I think we all are self-conscious when we're teenagers. And I'm just wondering if that's why you made that decision or how that came to be.
You know, again, I think I tend to be a very intuitive writer, so I think I just wrote the story. That's just how it came out, and it just seems to be right. But I think you did a really beautiful job of articulating probably why it seemed right and why I didn't later revise it to put it in third person or first person. I think that you know, when we look back at ourselves as teenagers, you know, what I remember for me, it was a time of intense self-consciousness and even self-loathing. And yet I look back now at myself as a teenager with much mm-hmm. more compassion. So I think that there's a way that there's something in that second person you voice that it's almost like my looking back from here on that self-loathing and trying to address it in a voice that has that acknowledges the full extent of the self-loathing and the mm-hmm. sense of humiliation I had about almost everything as a teenager, and yet really try to address it in a voice that's much more compassionate. So I think the you voice gives you both that closeness and that distance in some way.
Yeah, it totally. I mean, I was right there as soon as she started expressing any self-doubt. Because it was in that you, I was right there. I just knew exactly how she felt, because, of course, we've all felt that way. And, yes, I do think that voice is more compassionate. Well, you mentioned earlier the caretaker in the story, or you mentioned the story about the former ballerina who's been paralyzed by disease, and the story is written in her point of view and also that of her caretaker. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about this story. It was so wonderful. And, you know, talk about characters who are very far removed from my personal experience, and yet just I was so drawn into their story and felt what was going on for them. But I guess to start, I wanted to ask if you always have an innate sense of who will narrate a story that you're writing, or if you often have to grapple with that and come in at it from different angles before you decide who's telling the story.
I think I definitely have a sense of what I want to try,
mm-hmm.
but I think that there often are experiments that fail. So I have to go in with a sense that I have figured it out, but then as I write it, there's sometimes a sense that it's just not working. So with that story, I started from the point of view of the dancer and wrote the first section from her point of view, and the character of Malcolm, the caretaker, started to emerge from her point of view, but I didn't know where that story was going at all. And so the section that's then comes from his point of view, that was sort of a surprise to me that day, you know, that he just suddenly wanted to have a section and a voice that kind of came out of nowhere. So I think the answer is, I think there are writers who really know what they're trying to do before they get started. And for me, it really is just being willing to bumble forward and hope that it starts to really become clear. And when I'm writing, if I have a sense that I am trying to make something happen or make a story, it just is kind of dead,
right.
Which is not true for other writers. I think other writers work that way. But for me, I have to just feel my way through, grope my way along, and it really does start to emerge out of uncertainty. So he just kind of came out of nowhere as a character and started to really take on prominence. But when I started that story, I wasn't planning to write about a dancer and her caretaker. That emerged as I started to explore the characters.
Now, does that process tend to be exciting for you when you suddenly decide that he's going to have a voice, or is that almost like an overwhelming moment where you go, oh my God, now I have to figure out what this guy's thinking?
No, that part is thrilling, but the part before that is horrible.
The grappling, the stumbling in the dark.
You kind of feel like there's something there and you don't know what it is, or where you feel like there's nothing there. One time I was, it's funny, I do a lot of my writing. I love to go away to artist colonies, and I've had a number of residencies in the last 8 years, which is when my writing started to really take off in a different way. And I have this myth that when I go away to a colony, the floodgates open and I'm just in a trance and all this wonderful stuff is happening every minute. And in fact, by the end of the residency, I do have a great pile of exciting work always.
Okay.
But the reality of a working day is sometimes really hard. And I found a little journal entry in the middle of this residency that I remember as this perfect time of, you know, writing just gushing out. I found a little journal entry that said, "Today was like trying to scrape maple syrup off the floor of the Sahara Desert." And that is what it can feel like. You know, when it's not going, that's what it's so frustrating and it's so agonizing. And, I just think all writers go through it, and it's hard. But so to me, when the voice announces itself, when the caretaker comes forward and says, "My name is Malcolm and I want to have a voice in this story," that's actually a huge relief, because that usually comes after one of those scraping maple syrup off the floor of the desert kind of days.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. Well, without giving too much away, I will say that these characters, this woman who's in a wheelchair and her caretaker who happens to be gay, so they share a very intimate moment in the story. After many scenes in which they're mostly very careful around one another and sort of cautious in order to preserve the balance that they've found in their relationship. So I wondered if the intimate moment that you wrote between them was a difficult scene to write, or was it a relief? Was it sort of like what we've just talked about, where you kind of came upon the right thing to do?
I think it was both. I mean, I think what I wanted to do in that scene was, I wasn't sure how restrained to keep my sense that. I think you're absolutely right that one of the qualities that makes their relationship work is the restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt that this scene, I sort of knew what I wanted it to be, but I wanted it to be still restrained in the writing, that it's a scene where the characters let down their guard and let down their boundaries to some extent, but still keep their boundaries. And so I wanted to get the tone of it right. One of the things that I struggle with when I write, and I also think this is something that's true for many writers, is you kind of have these voices in your head that are the voices of your characters that are telling you what they need to do and what they need to be, but you also have voices in your head that are critical voices, you know, and some of it is when you're writing a scene like that, you sort of can hear someone saying, like, well, you can't do that, that's too sappy, you know, or you can't
right.
do that because nobody will understand what's going on, or you can't do that because somebody might think blah, blah, blah. And you just have to tell those voices, just shut up, just go away and shut up, because, you know, and it's hard, because I think that at some point you do have to go back and look at your manuscript with a critical voice, but hopefully not those voices are just mean, those are bullies. You don't want the bullies, but you do want to kind of be able to assess, did I hit this tone right, or was I sentimental, was I so cold that somebody won't get the warmth? So I think with that scene, the challenge was to write it in a way that felt deeply true, and I just had to kind of fight my own doubts while I was writing it, but I kind of, as long as I kept fighting my own doubts, I kind of knew what it wanted to be, and I mm-hmm. just tried to let it be that.
It felt so right. Let's see. Oh, I wanted to ask you about the story that features Rosina and Elvira.
Yeah.
You know, and these are historical characters from Mozart's operas, The Marriage of Figaro and Don Giovanni.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know you said that it's not always interesting to know where an author gets her ideas, but I did want to know, how did you come to do this, to reimagine them as modern characters?
Well, you know, I think one of the great themes of this book is love and humiliation. I think that, you know, so many of the feelings we have and so many of the experiences we have in love, you know, for me, they kind of go hand in hand with humiliation. And I think Mozart, the way Mozart and De Ponte, his librettist, wrote their women characters.
Mm.
I just think there is no greater example of women going through humiliating experiences in love, and yet somehow you feel that even though the women have been humiliated by love, they are not humiliated as characters. In other words, Mozart and De Ponte are not interested in humiliating women. They're interested in looking at what happens when women feel humiliated, and how do women maintain their dignity as human beings in situations that are actually quite humiliating. And I think I was drawn to those. I have loved those operas for years.
Okay.
And I just think they're gorgeous, gorgeous pieces of music. But I also think they're infinitely interesting in terms of character. And I think these women are women who are just triumphs of dignity and humanity, and have been, you know, treated really badly by men, and somehow we have enormous sympathy for them, and we think the men are kind of jerks. And so I wanted to see, like, what would happen if these two became friends and had a chance to compare experiences. And then I think I was also really interested in what do artists do with humiliation, you know, and love, they make art. And so I actually decided to make Elvira a painter, which she is not. There's no indication in Don Giovanni that she's a painter. She's just a a rich lady who loves and has been dumped by Don Giovanni. But I just thought, what if she's a painter, and what's she doing with this experience? And so I had a there are things in that story about what kind of paintings she does and why she does them. So
right.
To me, that whole idea of just putting these two people together, I felt like it was almost she who laughs last. It's a sort of story about women who have had not had the upper hand, kind of getting the upper hand, but hopefully not in a didactic way. I really believe these two would be friends and would have a lot to talk about.
You know, I thought it was totally fun and believable, and I loved the way that you brought their lives into the modern day and filled out, I mean, just apart from the painting, you know, just filled out everything around them and their stories, and went back in time and retold their stories in this contemporary manner. Anyway, it was really fun.
Mm-hmm. And you had asked earlier about, you know, whether the characters are planned or not, but in that story, somehow in the middle of the story, DePonte, the librettist, mm-hmm. just jumped into that story as a voice. And that was a complete surprise to me and a real delight. You know, that was just really fun. I love that, you know, when you're writing, you can sometimes get these surprises. And as I say, sometimes I think you have to work against it. You have to just say, well, that's, you know, that was a fun exercise for a Saturday morning, but it doesn't belong in the story. And then other times it jumps in and it's actually quite odd, but maybe the oddness is okay. And
right.
In this case, I felt that it actually added something else to the story, because there were a lot of things that, you know, in a way, DePonte and Mozart, that's a different kind of love story, you know, the love story between collaborators.
Yeah, right. And I think what you just said is perfect. You know, it's what's best for the story. You know, I mean, at one point you might find yourself writing something and then you realize, well, that's just entertaining myself, but that's not
yes.
what's best for the story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think you can't know that when you're writing. I think when you're writing, you have to just be willing to just throw it all in there, and then it's later when you apply that editorial voice that you can sort of make those judgments about, is this good for the story or not? But I think you're absolutely right. I think that is the crucial question to ask in the revising process: is this right for the story?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So your 2009 memoir, The Suicide Index, was a National Book Award finalist, and it dealt with some very difficult personal material about the suicide of your father. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about being nominated for that award. How was that for you, and particularly given the book and all that went into it, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was actually wonderful. It was a complete surprise to me, and really deeply wonderful, partly because I had worked on that book for such a long time. I had worked on that book for over a decade before I found the right way to tell the story. It began as a novel, kind of a third-person family novel, and it just felt too distant, too polite, not at all reflective of the chaos that ensues when someone you love kills himself. And I had then reimagined it as a memoir done in fragments, and then eventually I put the fragments in an index format, partly to put them in order, but also to emphasize in an ironic way that you can't put that stuff in order, because mm-hmm. suicide is chaotic. And so it was a very, personal. It was a very personal book, and the process of writing it was a long personal process. But I also felt I wasn't just writing a journal for myself. I was writing something that I hoped would really convey to other people what the experience of going through a family suicide was like. And to have the National Book Award nomination was really wonderful, because I felt that it was acknowledging the book as a piece of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt that, you know, I wasn't just writing it to kind of do a public service and talk about suicide, although I certainly hope the book did that as well. But I wanted people to pick it up who didn't necessarily have suicide in their families and who didn't, you know, didn't need it, but just were curious about a piece of writing. And I felt
yeah.
that the National Book Award gave it a much greater recognition and a much greater likelihood that people would just pick it up as a piece of work, a piece of writing.
I'm really drawn to the idea that you put it as an index.
what I care about the most when I'm writing is finding the right way to tell that story.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that the index, in a way, if I had started with that idea, I don't know if it would have been it could have been gimmicky, but I think because that idea came, you know, 9 years into a 10-year writing process, I feel like it was earned and it came out of that story and that material. So I really feel like I really care about structure and I really care about form much more than I do about genre, for example. You know, people sort of say, oh, you write memoir and you write fiction. And I feel like, yeah, I guess I do. But it's more just what's the right way to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the right way for that story. And for these yearning love stories, I think that this structure, you know, the news from Spain in a way is a very formal structure. To have 7 stories with the same title, that's a very formal architecture. But I think that within that formal architecture, then I can have all these messy emotions. So I think, you know, in a way, even though it's 2 very different books, they're sort of the same in that they really were, the process of writing them was really about trying to find the right structure and the right form for that to contain that particular set of stories and emotions.
Yeah, although it's interesting, it sounds to me a little bit like you had the news from Spain structure before you wrote the stories, and that maybe that structure helped you to write the stories, whereas it almost sounds like with the Suicide Index, you had all this material, and you were looking for a way to put it together. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Or? I think that's right, and I think that the thing that they have in common is that it's more just that that's what survived. I think you're right that in terms of how it happened, you know, which was the chicken and which was the egg, I think it's a little different with the two books, but I think that the reason why I decided the books were finished when they were in that form is sort of the same. It's the same.
Yeah.
It was the same goal, but I got to that goal in different ways with the 2 different books.
Well, I was going to ask you a question about having decided to use an index as an organizing principle, but I didn't understand at the time that I was making up my questions that, in fact, you already had a lot of material when you decided to do that. So
yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe because it was a memoir, you had to figure out a way to decide what to use, maybe, and how to use it. Is that?
I think that's right, and I think it was also, I think there's something about suicide that what I found was that it resists all the ordinary things I knew about storytelling in terms of chronology and the arc of a story and character
yeah.
development and epiphany and all this. That whole feeling that you have with a conventional structure where it builds and you're kind of getting to something, I felt that suicide is not, there's nothing unified about suicide. It's a shatter. It's a kind of a shattering experience. And for me, the only real understanding I ever gained about suicide was finally accepting that I would never really understand. And I think there's actually a great amount of peace that comes from that. But I had to find a structure that would allow that sort of chaotic set of fragments to somehow exist and yet not leave a reader feeling like, oh, this is a chaotic book.
Right, right.
So I think that was the challenge, was how do you write about a chaotic experience in a way that doesn't create a chaotic book?
And also, I wonder, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I wonder, too, if it's not a little harder to write about your life as art, and to feel like, well, you know, this was my life. I don't know. Does that ring a bell?
No, it absolutely does. I mean, it's interesting because I've got a section in the middle of the Suicide Index where I talk really pretty just frankly about biography and the whole problem of biography and how, you know, lives are just messy and mm-hmm. biographies organize them and select certain things to include and other things to leave out. And they're always false in some way, you know, just because you're changing. Anytime you make something into a story, you're changing the nature of it, which I feel like in a way is part of what's wrong with stories, but it's also part of why we love them, I think.
Okay,
you know, it's
yeah.
Part of why it's so satisfying to read a story, because in a way a story is trying to make sense of something.
Yes. Which, you know, and then the sort of subject of fiction versus memoir becomes interesting again. You talked about this a minute ago, but also in an interview about the Suicide Index that I read, you said that when you tried to write the story as fiction, it was too muted and indirect. And then later you said, you know, it's not just about switching from third person to first person. It's about coming out from behind the protective covering of fiction to say this happened. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, as I was reading the news from Spain, I noticed that you have a story. I think it's the last story in the collection mm-hmm. that begins, some of this is fiction and some isn't. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, you know, just looking at all these statements, I wondered if that then also carries its own power for the story. You know, how does a story benefit from the statement that the work is fiction and it's influenced by truth and the reader won't necessarily know what's real?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a playful statement, really. And I think it's not me saying that it's fiction or not fiction, it's the narrator. And so I think part of the conception for that last story, and I don't know whether anybody else will ever get this, but the thing that was helping me as I was writing it is I was imagining actually that last story is almost like it's fiction in the form of an essay. It's like it's like written the way one would write an essay, but it's also the character writing the essay is a character. That's too complicated, but that's sort of what I was thinking anyway. And I was thinking about also that story goes back and forth between the personal story of the woman who is narrating the story, which is this narrator has fallen in love with a guy who, she has a very happy marriage, but she's fallen in love with a guy who's not her husband. She's never going to act on it, but the feelings are really uncomfortable, and she's blurting things out. You know, she's kind of making declarations to this guy that she doesn't really want to make, but she can't stand not to make, and it's just, you know, it's really about this whole inner thing that goes on when you get a crush on someone, even when you're in a happy marriage. And that's intertwined with another story, another narrative within that story, which is a very famous woman. It's 1944. She's the most famous woman in the world. And so you can sort of figure out who that would have been. Yep. And she's in love with her doctor, who is 15 years younger than she is. And she falls in love with him. And so also a kind of potentially humiliating experience of falling in love outside the lines.
Right.
And so in a way, the piece that starts it says some of this is fiction and some of it isn't. It's also partly some of this is based on a story from history about this, you know, this famous woman that fell in love with her doctor. It's a playful, I think it's a playful story, but it's also, you're right, it's playing with genre and it's playing with where, in any piece of literature, where does fiction, what's the boundary between fiction and nonfiction?
The story that we were talking about that starts out, some of this is fiction and some isn't. Starting the story that way reminded me a little bit of when a story begins with a statement that says the narrator is not necessarily reliable. Not because it's the same thing, but because it gives the reader something to question. And I enjoyed that because it's really fun to read the story and still have that little tiny question in the back of your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. It's almost like a little warning that just says, you know, take this with a grain of salt.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I wondered, Joan, if you could talk a little bit about who are some of your favorite writers or some of your favorite books?
I think I can answer that question in so many different ways. I've got my kind of perennial favorites, and then I've got my more recent, you know, the ones that are sort of right on the tip of my tongue right now because I've just finished reading them or have just read them. So I think I would start there. The book that I read most recently that I got really excited about is a new novel by A.M. Holmes called May We Be Forgiven. And I loved it because it is very dark and very, very funny, but it has... It, without being at all sappy, it has a very great heart, and I felt like it's kind of a combination of brilliant comedy, kind of brilliant social comedy, but with a real sort of interesting, empathic character running at the heart of it. So I loved that book. I found that it was a real page turner, but also something that really made me think. And I just couldn't wait to get to it at the end of the day. So that would be one.
Have you read her work before? Are you a fan of her from before?
No, I haven't really read her work. I've read some of her short stories before and loved them, but this was the first novel of her, so it was actually a novel that I liked enough that I went out and bought a whole bunch of other books.
I'm
looking forward to reading more. Right now I'm reading, I just started a novel by Madeline Miller called The Song of Achilles.
Okay.
Which I love. It's basically a retelling of the events of the Iliad, but through the voice of a guy who's kind of a minor character in the Iliad, but really reimagining the events with, again, putting an emotional core. And I think it's beautifully written, and I'm really, that's the one I can't wait to pick up at night right now.
That's great.
And then my perennial ones, Middlemarch. I love Middlemarch because I think the psychology of it is just still so true. And she has the most populated world, and you feel like she has compassion for every single person in that world, you know, the good guys and the jerks and you sort of feel like everybody's a good guy and a jerk. And I really love it. And I feel like I read it over again, probably every decade. And each time I read it, my understanding of it changes because of where I am in my life. Mm-hmm. It's one of those books that you read it and you get so involved in her world and her town and her people, but you also feel she's telling you so much about where you are in your life right
then. That's great. That's a great way of putting that. And it's such a talent, isn't it, for a writer to have compassion for all of their characters, even the ones that aren't necessarily supposed to be liked by the reader.
Yeah. Every now and then I will read a book where I feel like the writer is humiliating the characters. And I just, that turns me off so much.
Yes.
I just feel like, you know, it feels unfair and you lose me at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe a little bit easy, too. You know, I mean, I think it's so easy to paint the world in black and white. What are you working on now, Joan?
Well, I'm sort of in that blundering in the dark phase with something new. I have, you know, again, I've got a pile of paper. I sort of know what I'm writing about, but it's just, I know it's wrong. And so I know it's wrong, and I don't know how close I am to that moment where I suddenly know what I'm doing. So it's actually, I'm back at square one, is the truth. I feel like I'm bumbling and blundering and trying to remind myself that this is how, you know, everything starts. You know, and I think that's a good thing for writers to admit out loud, because I tend to have to fight my own, you know, even after all these years, this misconception I have that writers sit down and type page one, and then they just keep typing till they get to page 300. They box it all up and send it to the publisher. And I don't think that books actually get written that way. But even after a, you know, 30-year career as a writer, I still think I'm doing it wrong, because it doesn't happen that way. And in fact, I just feel like, well, it doesn't.
But it's so good to hear that, and for people who write, it will be so good to hear my guest, who's a National Book Award finalist, saying that she struggles with the same thing when she starts a new project.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really, really good to be frank about it, because I think, you know, that's what we all struggle against. I mean, the thing with writing is you're doing something, no matter what you're writing something that doesn't exist yet. And so there's just no way there's no one who can tell you you're doing it right. By the same token, there's no one who should tell you that you're doing it wrong.
Right.
You know, I just think it's really about just having the faith to just try to get it down. And then whatever you want to do with it after that, you know, you can publish it or not publish it, or edit it or not edit it. But I think that the real trick is just to have enough faith to just try to get it down.
To just get it down. So that actually brings me really neatly into my last question with you, which is, if you can offer some advice for writers about tackling revision. So if you get it down, let's say that you get it down and then you realize, okay, I've decided I want to revise this and make it into something more finished. How do you approach revision? What's your process like?
Well, I would say for me, it has to do with, the first thing is to just be willing to let it sit for some time. I think that writers tend to be very impatient. They want to get it finished. They want to get it, you know, cleaned up, and they want to send it out. And I've learned to just sit on things, just let it cool off for longer than you think, so that you can come back to it with a more objective eye. I think to be really honest, when something is not working, if something just strikes you as you know, this is just then you're probably right. And I think that's important to listen to that voice. I would say also be careful who you show things to. Mm. I think there are people who are really eager to tell you what they would do, but that's different from helping you see what you need to do.
Okay.
Sometimes I think it's good to have some readers that are not writers, because they won't try to tell you. You know, the job of a reader is to tell you what's on the page and what isn't. And then it's up to you to decide what to do with that. And for me, sometimes revising means throwing something out and not even looking at it and starting over. You know, having been through that same material, but coming to it fresh. That's how I revise a lot of the time, which is not true of most writers. I think most writers go through the manuscript and add and subtract, but I tend to just really throw things out and start over.
Oh, good for you. That is just such a hard step to take, though.
Well, it is, and sometimes I think it's probably not the right advice for someone else, because, you know, sometimes I think people throw out really good stuff, but most of the time for me, when I've thrown stuff out and then gone back and looked at it again, it wasn't really that good. There was some kind of internal problem. And then I would say just read, because I think you develop an ear and you develop a sense of cliche and a sense of when something feels vivid and specific enough. I just keep pushing to make things more vivid and more specific and more individual. And I think, you know, the more true you can make it, whether you're writing memoir or fiction, the more true it feels, the better it'll be. And so I sort of push. When I'm revising, a lot of times I'll sort of find stuff that feels like it's too general, and I have to make it more specific.
Okay, great. Wonderful advice. Well, Joan, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, well, thank you. This has been a wonderful conversation.
That author's name, again, is Joan Wickersham. Her new book is The News from Spain, published by Knopf. And you can find out more about her work at joanwickersham.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Joan Wickersham. When she teaches, she often encourages her students to read Tim O'Brien's extraordinary collection, The Things They Carried, and to read the title story from that collection. And then after reading that story, which is in fact a long list, make your own list. In fact, Joan suggests making a list of lists or types of lists. What are some ideas for structuring a story in the form of a list? Here are a few ideas I've come up with. You could write down a grocery list, a packing list, a to-do list, a category on Craigslist. Come up with a few of your own and then pick one and see if you can write a story using that list form as a structural device or just for inspiration. Good luck with this prompt and tune in next week for another. You already know this. If you listen every week, Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us. And if you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, if you have a writing prompt to suggest, or if you'd like to request that I try to contact a favorite author and request an interview, please send an email to me at writethebook@gmail.com. And then, as always, please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. Everything that happens at The Radiator happens thanks to volunteers. And more information about getting involved is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.